We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. During the 3.5 years that Cambodia was ruled by the Khmer Rouge, it's estimated that 2 million people died. This is a story that's well known. Perhaps also people will know that after that time, the Khmer Rouge were driven from power by Vietnam. In the early 90s, Cambodia became a UN protectorate. The country got a new constitution and held elections. The country got the chance to start over. In this hour, we'll be talking with journalist Joel Brinkley. He first went to Cambodia as a journalist in 1979. In fact, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on Cambodia. In 2008, he had the chance to go back to see whether or not things had changed. And his new book, Cambodia's Curse, The Modern History of a Troubled Land, he reports that, in fact, in many ways, things haven't changed for most of the people who live in Cambodia. We'll talk with Joel Brinkley in this hour of our show, and questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. Joel Brinkley is professor of journalism at Stanford. He's a 23-year veteran of the New York Times. He's worked in more than 50 nations and writes a nationally syndicated op-ed column on foreign policy. His book is published by Public Affairs Books, is out now in the bookstore. And certainly questions are welcome. We hope people will be brief so we can keep our program moving. And we hope people will be on the topic. But certainly other than that, your comments and questions are welcome. You can be part of the show. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. The toll-free line is 800-222-9455, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that. And you can also send us an email if you would like. The address is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, like it sounds, at illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions certainly are welcome. And Mr. Brinkley, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I think you make a basic point here that people they probably are fairly familiar with the story, at least with the basics of the story about what happened in Cambodia during the time of the Khmer Rouge, and they may also know that well that time ended, and the country did have this opportunity to make a new start. I think though that you're cautioning people that yes, the country made a new start, but for so many in Cambodia, particularly people who live in the rural parts of the country, life really hasn't changed very much.
That's exactly right. The biggest problem Cambodia faces right now is that everyone knows that we, the United States, bombed Cambodia during the Vietnam War. Most people know about the Khmer Rouge disaster, and some people know about the UN occupation. But it has disappeared from the world stage since then. You ask anybody who has a little bit of knowledge about Cambodia, and he'll tell you, oh, they're so much better off than they were during the Khmer Rouge years. Well, under that umbrella, under that sort of protective statement, the government, the dictatorship that rules Cambodia today can do whatever it wants, and no one really notices. No one really cares. It's a country that has simply disappeared. Mm.
And for most of the people, it sounds as if over time, most of the people in Cambodia lived in the countryside. They were subsistence farmers, had a pretty poor life. That's the way it was when the Khmer Rouge came to power. That's the way it really still was when they were swept from power. And it sounds as if that's really the way it still is today, so that the way that people live, their lifestyle, what constituted their life, it sounds like the point that you make is that really it hasn't changed in something like 1,000 years.
That's the way it was during the Khmer Rouge. That's the way it was when the kings of Angkor ruled the area in 1000 AD. 80% of the nation's people, 80% live in the countryside. Nearly all of those people live more or less as they did 1,000 years ago or 40 years ago. They live without electricity, without food, natural gas for cooking, without any of the, without telephones, or some, most of them don't have televisions or anything like that. They don't live with anything that looks like it could have been out of place 500 years ago.
Hmm. When the Khmer Rouge came into power, one of the things that they did is they cleared out the cities. They had this idea that everybody should go back to this kind of rural-based agrarian lifestyle. And that where that was where most of the people actually lived before. I don't know that there really were a lot of big cities in Cambodia. Who now lives in the city, and what is the state of city life?
Well, just for a little background, when the Khmer Rouge came to power, because the United States had been bombing eastern Cambodia, it had driven millions of people from the countryside into Phnom Penh. So Phnom Penh actually had a population of 3 million out of about 7.5 million. Those were the most of the people who were driven out of the city were relatively newcomers to the city in any case. Within the city, the largest employer is the government. A lot of patronage positions, a lot of people who sit around and have nothing to do except take bribes. There is a burgeoning but still rather small middle class and educated population of young people, but the dream for any young person in Cambodia today, for the 3% who actually graduate from college, is to work for the government, because in the government you get into the patronage system, into the bribe system, and you can make yourself rich. The universities can't get anybody to study agriculture, engineering. They all want to study management so that they can work in the government.
Mm. One of the points you make is that corruption is in the society is so widespread that it's really stunning. But you talk about the fact that if you want to go to school, you have to pay a bribe to the teacher. If you have a business, you need some kind of permit. You pay a bribe to an official. You have something that goes to court. You're in court. You want to get a judgment in your favor. You bribe the judge. It sounds as if that is it's simply the way of life.
It's endemic, and I've worked in a lot of corrupt countries, and in fact, we have corruption in this country, a lot of it, except the difference here is that we prosecute it when we find it. What I found in Cambodia that seemed to me to be more damaging was that corruption actually killed people. You're a poor person. You go to the hospital. You have a problem. The doctor says, here's what we can do. If you give me $500, I'll do it. And if you don't, they let you die. 6-year-olds go to school, and they have to pay a bribe to the teacher every day for the privilege of going to school. When you get into upper grades, the teacher will sell you the answers to tests. So the people who come out of school, the ones who have a little bit of money, probably never learned anything because they bought their way through all of it. It's a system with a long and dark history, but one that really leaves the country with uneducated and people who are, deeply harmed by it.
Yeah. It strikes me, and it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning about the fact that Cambodia just doesn't get a whole lot of attention from the rest of the world right now. Go back to this idea that I think probably a lot of people, and if your baseline of comparison is the time of the Khmer Rouge, well, yes, I think you would have to say that things are better now. But you get this impression that, oh, Cambodia's it has moved ahead, it's modernizing, it has great potential, it's a booming place, the economy is in better shape. And in fact, I think to the extent that there are surveys done, many Cambodians would say, oh, yes, we think our country is doing well and we're moving ahead and we're going in the right direction.
In fact, the International Republican Institute, which is a federally funded outfit in Washington that promotes democracy around the world, carries out surveys in a lot of countries, including Cambodia. They go around the country every few years and interview people, and This most recent survey, which I believe was 2 years ago, found that 75% of Cambodians believe that the country is going in the right direction. That is an anomaly, it seems, but it isn't really, because Cambodians have been conditioned by heritage, by religion, and by their government not to expect anything more than they have.
It seems, now that this is a point, this is a strong point that you make, and it does seem also the point that some people, some reviewers and others, want to take issue with, that the idea that there is this passivity among the Cambodian people, and that it in part has to do with their orientation as Buddhists, that they tend to say, well, we take what comes. You have to take what comes. And I guess I wonder how you feel about that particular criticism, that maybe you're putting too much stress on that point.
I would, you know, I've seen those reviews and I take issue with them myself. Mm. How many countries in, for example, the Middle East or any of these other places that are having uprisings right now, if you had done a survey among the people a year ago, before there was an uprising, a confidential survey, would 75% of them have said, oh, everything's just fine, we're happy, you know, I don't think that would have happened. In fact, I know in Egypt there were surveys, and more than a year ago, more than 50 or 60% of the people said they were very upset about the state of their lives.
And as far as the United States government is concerned and the way that it thinks about Cambodia, if today you go to Washington and you talk to people in the administration or in the foreign policy community, and you say to them, well, why aren't we paying attention to Cambodia? Why doesn't it matter more to us? Would they simply, if they were being honest, would they simply look at you and say, well, that's because Cambodia just it doesn't matter. It has no strategic significance for the United States. So, you know, we got a lot of other more important things to worry about.
I don't agree with that. Now, certainly Cambodia is not as important to the United States as Iran or some of these other countries that we deal with all the time. But you think about it, the U.S. has made great efforts to create strong and important relationships with Japan and India and South Korea and other countries in and around China. And part of the reason, they won't really say it quite this way, but part of the reason is to have a bulwark of friendly nations around China. Well, China is actually right now buying Cambodia. There's no secret about it. If we're so interested in having counterpoints to China in the region, why not make an effort with a country that almost borders China, that is right there in the center of Asia?
Let me introduce our guest again very quickly, Joel Brinkley. He's a journalist. He's professor of journalism at Stanford and worked for 23 years for the New York Times. He reported on Cambodia going back to 1979, in fact, won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on Cambodia, not for the New York Times, but as a reporter for the Louisville Courier-Journal newspaper. And just fairly recently, after almost 30 years, this was in 2008, he went back to Cambodia because he was interested in finding out what was going on in Cambodia today. And he has put that into the book that we're talking about. The title of the book is Cambodia's Curse, The Modern History of a Troubled Land. Public Affairs is the publisher. The number, if you'd like to call in, you can certainly join the conversation. The number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you like, you can also send an email. The address is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. We do have a caller here. Let's bring him in. And they are in Urbana, here where we are. And this is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thanks for the show. Appreciate your time, Mr. Brinkley. My question is, you're talking about a lot of, you know, people being dissatisfied. It's come to light in America and other Western countries that just because we have all the modern amenities in our homes and make a lot more money, it doesn't make us more happy. So when I hear you speaking about that these people live in a similar fashion as they lived 1,000 years ago, to me it doesn't ring automatically that that would make people unhappy. I mean, one study I was reading not long back was that in India, people are generally more happy than they are in, say, the United States, even though we all know that most of them are much more poverty-stricken than, by our standards, than we are. So could you sort of blend that into your conversation? And have there been any studies in Cambodia that would, you know, that just address happiness? I mean, people talk about security, food, shelter, and family. Those are being sort of like the cornerstones of happiness. Not television, not cell phones, iPads, Xboxes, and all that stuff. So can you talk a little bit on those lines? It just makes me feel a little uneasy that, you know, yet again, maybe we're going to export our American happiness to some other country. I mean, it doesn't seem to be working out in Iraq and Iran, the type of exporting we're doing right now. Thanks for your time again.
All right.
I'll take my answers off the air.
All right. Thank you for the comment. You can take that on however you like.
Well, I appreciate the comment, and I can see your point, but I would like to suggest and point out that these people aren't just living quietly in the countryside, growing their rice and picking fruit off trees. Their government doesn't just leave them alone. It abuses them. Thousands and thousands of people are thrown out of their homes every year by the government. The homes are burned. They're driven away, thrown into rice fields, and then their property is sold to a developer. 40% of the nation's children grow up stunted. 40%, that means they don't grow physically or mentally because of malnutrition in the first years of life. They grow up short and not very smart. 75% of Cambodians contract dysentery every year, and 10,000 of them die. I could go on and on. It is not a Pacific wonderful life in the sunshine. These people are abused, and 10% of them are classified by UNICEF as wasting, which means that they are starving to death. And so maybe they don't have iPads, but I don't think that's really the issue.
So setting aside things like surveys just based on asking a question, well, are you happy with your life? If you take a look at fairly objective standards of well-being that we would like to see across the world, things like, do people get an adequate diet? Do they have access to some kind of health care? Do their children have access to some kind of education? What's the basic elements of their life? On all of those things, you would argue that the people of Cambodia are at some of the very bottom rungs of the ladder.
Absolutely true. And in addition to that, almost half of the people who survived the Khmer Rouge regime have PTSD, which is, and other traumatic illnesses, which pervade the entire country. And Cambodia is the only place in the world where it has been shown that post-traumatic stress disorder is actually being passed to a second generation.
That's really, both of those things are really stunning facts. That first of all, that in round figures, 30 years after the time of Khmer Rouge, there should still be people who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, people who lived through that. That's an amazing statistic in and of itself. But the other one, PTSD, it's not, I don't think that people are used to thinking of it like it's an infectious disease, you know, like it could be passed on from parent to child. But in this particular case, that seems to be true.
What happens is that the parents who have this mental illness behave in such a paranoid and sometimes passive and sometimes extremely violent manner. When you grow up in a household with parents who are behaving that way, and just suffer from this trauma every single day, then you grow up having the same perceptions about the world that your parents do, and you end up having something very similar to PTSD yourself.
Another caller here, someone in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello, Dale. Hey, listen, I just wanted to call and kind of not let the other caller's comments get easily dismissed. I agree with the other caller considerably, and I hear in this conversation here this notion of the Americans knows best formula, and a number of these difficulties and problems that we're discussing here, and as if we know how to resolve them with our particular style, exist only in our own country. And sometimes I think it's to our advantage to look somewhere else and see how bad somebody else is doing and say, oh, look, you know, we were doing better. I'm from Pittsburgh. I just visited my home. And if I didn't know any better, if you blindfolded me and dropped me off there, I would think I was in some third world country. So some of this stuff, we need to clean up our own act before we get ourselves so concerned about what's going on, bad or worse, in some other place. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, again, Mr. Brigley, you can react to that however you like.
Sir, I agree with you, and I've spent much of my life reporting on things in the United States, and we have many, many serious problems of our own. But there is a primary rule that foreign correspondents use when covering other countries, and I've worked in dozens of countries, and that is that you never take your own values, the own cultural traditions of your own country, whether it's the United States or any other country, and impose it on another country. You just don't do that. That's not fair. And I don't think I have done that in Cambodia. I have, as I'm sure all of you do, a natural human compassion that says people have the right to live with enough food to eat, with education for their children and health care for the sick, and hopefully a bit of freedom. I don't think it's unfair to impose that sort of thinking on a third world country. And that's sort of how I've approached Cambodia. I've been in many countries where people live, a portion of the population lives in poverty the way they do in Cambodia, and in fact, not as severe. There's a lot of poverty in this country, but I've never been a place where it is so pervasive and where the country, where the nation's leaders who live in homes the size of small hotels so easily and shamelessly abuse their own people.
This you get to what was going to be my next question would be, well, for those people who constitute the elite of the country, how do they live?
Quite well. In fact, I mentioned that so many of the people in the country are malnourished. The leaders of the country, the people walking the halls of government, are the only ones you will find anywhere in the nation who are overweight. I did a rough calculation of, I went to the home of the deputy prime minister. I couldn't do the prime minister because he was building himself a new mansion, so it wasn't finished yet. I went to the mansion where the deputy prime minister lives and did a rough calculation and estimated that his house is 60,000 square feet. These people live like sultans.
We'll take another caller here. We'll go to, next to Urbana in line one. Hello?
Yeah, thank you. I'm very glad you're presenting this. I'm really worried about the corruption, you know, that you talk about. However, you know, have you been to, you know, countries? It sounds exactly like what happens in most third world countries. I would tell you, example would be Nigeria, exactly what happens. I mean, you cannot go to school unless you pay a bribe. You cannot, practically everything. You have to pay a bribe, which is very sad. And this is what a lot of us who live in the United States don't experience, and that's the basic difference. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, you comment on that if you like.
Absolutely. I have not been to Nigeria, but I've been to several African countries around it. As I've mentioned, corruption is pervasive around the world, and some countries handle it well by prosecuting malefactors. Other countries, the leaders benefit from it, and Nigeria, I'm sure, is one of those. I don't suggest that corruption is unique to Cambodia, but when I look at that particular country, I find that corruption is so destructive. I'll give you one example, and it may occur in Nigeria and other places too. Businesses owe taxes at the end of the year, of course, just as they do in many countries. The tax collector comes to a shop and tells the shop owner, you owe $28,000 in taxes. The taxes would then, if paid, go to pay for schools and hospitals and other things. But the tax collector says, if you pay me $24,000, I will say that you paid your taxes and you'll save $4,000. That happens all the time. So it starves the government of any legitimate income and ensures that there aren't money for schools or hospitals or any of the other services that the government provides.
And this, I guess, again, this we can connect with what's going on today with what was going on in the past. This sort of business of skimming by government officials, and everybody as the tax, whether that's what it used to be was rice, or whether it is now something else, as the tax is collected and it gets passed up and up, everybody on every layer of administration, there's some skimming. Somebody takes their cut, and then they pass on to the next person, and that person takes their cut. And it seems that's the way things have worked in Cambodia for a long time.
In fact, during the years when the Angkor Kingdom ruled most of Southeast Asia, the king accrued his income by appointing mandarins to go out to the farms and collect the rice crop. The lowest level mandarin would take some for himself, pass it up. The next fellow would take some for himself, and so it would go up the chain until the bulk of it went to the king. That's the way it works today, exactly.
The guest in this hour focus is Joel Brinkley, and we are talking about his recent book, Cambodia's Curse, The Modern History of a Troubled Land. He reported on Cambodia back in 1980 to 1979, won a Pulitzer Prize for his writing, went back recently to find out what was going on in Cambodia today. And that's what he put in the book, Cambodia's Curse. We'll have more in our conversation with Joel Brinkley after a short break. This is Focus.
I'm David Teal from WILL-TV. Join me this October for a Friends of WILL tour of London, Yorkshire, and Wales. We'll see stately homes and splendid scenery with connections to some of our most popular TV programs. Three-night stays in each of our locales offer us plenty of free time. Call us at 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu for more information.
WILL programs are made possible by Auditory Care Center, an independent hearing care center serving Champaign, Piatt, Ford, Vermilion, and other East Central Illinois counties. Auditory Care Center offers hearing evaluations as well as selection, fitting, and repair of hearing aids at 892-5959 in Rantoul.
This is Focus. We're here weekday mornings with 10 different conversations for you on the program on Monday in the 10 o'clock hour. Cecilia Menivar will be our guest. She's a professor at Arizona State. She'll be visiting the campus. We'll talk about immigration reform and the lives of Latino immigrants in America today. We'll also talk about a number of another foreign affairs topic. We'll be talking about Congo and what's been going there over the last few years. And our guest there is Jason Stearns. He is working on a PhD at Yale. He's a journalist, and we'll be talking about a new book that he's authored, which is titled Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, The Collapse of the Congo and the Great War of Africa. That will be Monday in our 11 o'clock hour. If you'd like to get the schedule for next week, you can go to our website. That way you can also listen to some past programs you may have missed. It's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour, we're talking with journalist Joel Brinkley. He is the author of the new book, Cambodia's Curse, The Modern History of a Troubled Land, published by Public Affairs. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Let us go on here, and we have another caller here, someone in Effingham on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. This program is so indicative of the 10,000-year history of males and their effect they have and while they're in power. It's so broad that if I could bring it home for my participation just now about what happened to Native Americans. And the paradigm seems to be the same as your guest, who I think he must be quite a gentleman to have saw and endured those things that he's talking about. But it is not anything new. And that's what strikes me most. The more I read, the more I study and write and do those things, and how the effects of the way Homo sapiens society is organized from the event of written history and through now and on to places like Cambodia and then Myanmar, I think it is. And recently I saw a piece where they're clearing the jungle and building the mansions that your guest talked about. And I wonder if he might, if he could, to blend in the similarities that now are worldwide and are terribly destructive. Thank you very much.
Well, you can respond to that. I don't know how sweeping one wants to be in talking about conditions in Cambodia and in other places.
I perfectly understand what the gentleman is saying, and I get comments like that all the time because I write a syndicated column in which I talk about individual countries, and I get lots of feedback asking, well, you know, the United States doesn't do it so well either, or something like that. I am of the view that when you write about the world, each country has the right to be judged on its own merits and not necessarily compared to the United States or any other country. We have thousands of reporters right now. Actually, I was at a convention. I know the number, 4,745 newspaper reporters in this country covering events in the United States, historical and present day. I think Cambodia and other countries have the right to be judged on their own merits without comparison to us or anyone else.
Mm. Well, it does. Forgive me for doing just that, but it certainly does seem to be that Cambodia, in terms of just how bad the conditions are for most people in Cambodia, it stands out. It's a really stunning thing to note, for example, as you do, that the average income of people in North Korea is three times that of people in Cambodia. And we are used to thinking of North Korea as a place where the daily lives of most people are pretty grim.
I did a study of average annual incomes in Cambodia at $650 a year. The only two countries that I could find that were comparable were Bangladesh and Afghanistan.
So in what way is the our non-governmental organizations, people who are in the business of international relief and development, involved in Cambodia?
In a way that, in my view, is not very effective. Since the UN occupation of the country in 92 and 93, thousands of NGOs and donors have been stationed in Cambodia. And every year they hold a pledge meeting in which representatives of all of them meet with the government and talk about what they want to give the next year. But first, ambassadors and aid officers stand up and talk to Hun Sen, the prime minister, and other government officials and tell them the things they need to be working on: house evictions, education, health care, poverty, corruption. Every year, Hun Sen, the prime minister, stands up and says, yes, this year we're really going to work on these things. every year. The donors go back home. The prime minister goes back to business as usual, and the donors give them money. Last year it was $1.1 billion, and the government skims off the top of it, and the state of the people remains more or less the same, and then next year the ritual returns. I wrote a piece for the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago in which I said it's time for these donors to stand up and say, we're going to withhold our money until you meet these conditions, that you stop the home evictions, that you improve health care, and on and on. And in fact, the United States, there was a donor meeting last week. The United States did in fact stand up and said, I'm not sure we can continue giving you money the way we have been in the past.
I mentioned a little bit earlier just the very, very bare-bones kind of history that the Khmer Rouge, they were in power. They were swept from power by the Vietnamese. Then they became a UN protectorate. There was constitution. There were elections. In 1993, the country held its first ever elections. Pretty stunning turnout. 90% of the people voted and voted in the present government, and the present government has been there since. Is there much of an opposition or much in the way of political dissent in the country? Is that do they have any possibility of changing things?
There is, in fact, an opposition. Many countries that have fake democracies like Cambodia allow a small opposition to exist so they can pretend that it's democratic. Hosni Mubarak allowed small opposition parties in Egypt, for example. I don't think the main opposition leader, a fellow named Samranzi, is much better than the people who are in government now. I think he's a scoundrel, but Hun Sen 2 years ago managed to convict him of destruction of property because he ripped out a controversial border post with Vietnam, and convicted him, and I think he was sentenced to 10 years in prison, and now he lives in Paris. So the head of the main opposition party, the Samranzi party, is living in exile. So right now I don't think there is really much, if any, opposition, even enough to stand up and say anything.
Back to the phones again here. We'll talk with somebody in Kankakee, somebody on a cell phone. This is line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. The great program. You gentlemen stalled my thunder, but that's okay. Great minds think alike. Actually have two quick questions for you. One was actually a question of to mirror Cambodia up against what's happening now in the Middle East. And my question was going to be, do you think there's any hope of a similar uprising for the masses of people being suppressed? I think you more or less answered that, as far as the people have no expectations of their government, so they really think everything is fine. But my other question was, and perhaps you want to comment on that, I was curious as to the relationship Cambodia currently has with its neighbors, and primarily Vietnam, wondering if those neighbors are also turning a scant eye as to what's going on and really don't intend to get involved. And I'll go ahead and ring off things.
All right.
Vietnam actually installed Hun Sen, the prime minister, in power back in 1985 when Vietnam occupied the country. So Hun Sen remains quite close to Vietnam, and in fact closer than his people would like. Cambodians just don't like Vietnam. Thailand, to the west, they actually have a little shooting war right now over a disputed bit of territory. Thailand and Vietnam historically have invaded Cambodia off and on over hundreds of years. That stopped when the French occupied the country in the mid-19th century. Thailand occupied western Cambodia until about 100 years ago. So relations with the neighbors are hostile and controversial.
Well, there is also this complicated history between the West and Cambodia. Cambodia, like Vietnam, was a French colony, and I'm sure that in the ways, particularly the way here in the United States we think about the region, that's all tangled up with the Vietnam War. How are there some ways in which the relationship between the United States and Vietnam affects how it is that U.S. governments have thought about Cambodia?
During the Vietnam War, the United States thought of Cambodia simply as an ancillary territory to Vietnam and its only consideration. Even people who worked in the U.S. Embassy in Phnom Penh thought of Cambodia only in terms of whether Vietnamese troops were using the place as a sanctuary. It was always an afterthought. And William Shawcross, a British author, wrote a book about that period and called Cambodia the Sideshow. And I think that's true today. The United States actually has pretty good relationships with Vietnam. And Vietnam is a pure communist dictatorship. Hun Sen, the problem that Cambodia has is that the United Nations spent $3 billion, $3 billion in 1992-93 to set up this protectorate and to hold elections. The world invested a lot of time and money in that country, more than it has done in any nation since. And so there remains, for those who follow the country, great disappointment that that money was wasted.
So it's not the fact that the United States couldn't have looked favorably on the Khmer Rouge, but the fact that it was the Vietnamese that unseated Pol Pot and his regime, and then installed Hun Sen, who continues to be there now. Hasn't particularly been a problem for the United States?
We come back to the view that many people have in this country who don't pay close attention to Cambodia. Hmm. Oh, they're so much better off than they were during the Khmer Rouge years.
So what do you think the United States government could do to try to improve the lives of the majority of the Cambodian people?
You know, we the United States have a number of agencies whose purpose is to foster democracy around the world. There's the International Republic Institute, there's the National Democratic Institute, there's Freedom House. There are a whole bunch of these groups. After the fall of the Soviet Union, these groups sent workers all over Eastern Europe, including Ukraine and other places, to work with the people to create democratic institutions and, in fact, to foster uprisings. The uprising in Ukraine was financed and paid for by the United States. Well, in Cambodia, some of these same institutes are at work, but they're beating their head against the wall by supporting this fellow Samrun Z and hoping that he can actually win an election. I don't think that's ever going to happen. I think these institutions should do as they have done in Libya, as they've done in Syria, as they've done in Ukraine and other Eastern Europe countries, go out into the countryside, set up exile radio stations and TV stations, work with the people in the countryside to energize them. It's worked in other countries, and I think it could work in Cambodia.
But it sounds as if we keep coming back to this same issue, that is that people generally in the United States and maybe specifically in Washington, they're not really – Cambodia is just it's not on their radar screen. It's just – it isn't considered to be that important. So what you have to do is somehow – and maybe that's in fact one of your motivations for doing the book is to persuade people – that it does matter and that it is something that we should be paying attention to.
You know, when I started work on this book in January 2008, I did a Nexus search. Nexus is the news research database that carries news stories from newspapers and other publications around the world. At that moment, and for the month of January 2008, 3,010 stories included Vietnam in the headline, 3,443 stories included headlines with the word Thailand in the headline. For Cambodia, the number was 308. Hmm. Nobody pays any attention. And I guess you're right. One reason I wrote this book is I wanted people to see things are not so much better off now.
Well, this I expect for you that Cambodia in this story occupies a pretty important place in your life since you had been there going back to 1979 and had written about it. Was there something in particular that then back in 2008 or so, or maybe it was even before that when you made the first, when you were there back in Cambodia for the first time in all this, in all these years, something that made you want to do that? I mean, what was it that led you to think that this was something that needed to have some attention?
I'll be honest with you. I was in Cambodia in 1979, as you've said. But then I started, a few years later, started working for the Times, and I traveled widely, but I'd never been back to Cambodia. And like almost everybody in this country, I paid no attention to the place whatsoever. Well, in 2007, I started writing this column. And so in the summer of 2008, after it got syndicated, I realized, you know, if you want to write about foreign affairs, you should travel. So I decided to go back to Southeast Asia, which I think I find one of the most interesting places. And I picked three or four countries. And I said, well, I'm there. Why don't I just go back to Cambodia? I haven't been there in 30 years. And I did some research. And as a journalist, you know, I'm pretty accustomed to doing research on places I haven't been to figure out what's going on. And I found this amazing story that no one anywhere had it said anything to me about, that I knew nothing about. I sold an article to Foreign Affairs magazine, and once I went back in 2008 to research that article, I realized, good Lord, there's a book here. This is amazing. Nobody knows this.
It's been all these years after the time of the Khmer Rouge, and one of the things that I think is really sort of stunning is that while there have been these efforts to hold people accountable, that the first, and you tell me if I haven't got this right, though, the very first Khmer Rouge leader ever found to be guilty of war crimes for what happened during Khmer Rouge time, this just happened last summer. So all of those years after, and so far only one person really, and I believe this was the man who led this notorious concentration camp where so many people died.
Correct.
How is it that now, that all these years after, we just have only one person out of all of the people that were involved having been held accountable for what happened?
Well, several more people are their trial is going to begin in June. But the truth is that you have to remember that Hun Sen was a Khmer Rouge commander himself, and a number of people in government have Khmer Rouge backgrounds. So it was not to anyone in the government's benefit to hold trials of Khmer Rouge leaders. Mm. And this was an idea of a UN officer, and he pushed Cambodia to agree. But the government, the Cambodian government, insisted that the trial be limited to the four or five people who were named. And Hun Sen has fought the trial every minute of the day since then, trying to limit it. And there's only a few of them because it's 30 years later, and many of them are already dead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does the today in Cambodia, what sort of role does the monarchy play? Does it have any significant role?
It's a figurehead monarchy. It has no real power. And in fact, in recent months, the prime minister has been trying to, has chastised the king for taking small initiatives that he didn't like. The country was ruled by kings for all of time until 1970. But now the king is at best a figurehead.
Mm. Well, we're coming down to the point here. We have about a minute or so left. As you have said, this was something that you had reported on going back to 1979, And that then for a long time you weren't paying attention and you got engaged again and wanted to see what was going on and decided that it was something that people needed to know about. So now we have this book and you're talking about it. What would you like to see happen? Maybe it's sort of two questions, but what would you like to see happen and what do you actually think is going to happen?
I don't want to predict the future, but I would like to see the United States pay more attention and use whatever leverage it may have to benefit the people of that state. I hope that donors will find a backbone and decline to give money until certain things are done. I would like simply the West to pay a bit more attention to Cambodia, knowing that it is right there in the center of Southeast Asia, right next to China, and China is buying it, and we need to have friends and allies in the region.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Joel Brinkley. He's a professor of journalism at Stanford, a 23-year veteran of the New York Times. He has worked in more than 50 countries. He writes a nationally syndicated op-ed column on foreign policy. He won the Pulitzer Prize for international reporting for his reporting on Cambodia. He is the author of a recently published book that is titled Cambodia's Curse, The Modern History of a Troubled Land. Public Affairs is the publisher. And Mr. Brinkley, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.